Alexia Arthurs was born and raised in Jamaica and moved with her family to Brooklyn when she was 12. A graduate of Hunter College in the Iowa Writers' Workshop, she has been published in Granta, the Suwanee Review, Small Axe, Virginia Quarterly Review, Vice, and the Paris Review, which awarded her the Plimpton Prize in 2017. Her debut collection is How to Love a Jamaican. It is published by Ballantine Books, and we are going to chat about it this morning. Alexia, welcome.
Hi, I'm so glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for coming on. So before we dive into the collection, I'd love for you to talk just a bit about your early relationship to writing, if it was something that you kind of always relied upon as a way to process the world and your move to the U.S. and your childhood, or if it kind of came later on.
Yeah, it was pretty early. At some point in middle school, I had a writing assignment for a class, and I hadn't done much creative writing at that time. And I was just so struck by how fun it was and by how moved I was by the language that I always knew that I wanted to be a writer, but I didn't have encouragement when I was growing up in high school. So in high school, actually, I took a lot of art classes. I took photography and ceramics, but not so much writing because it just wasn't offered at my high school in Brooklyn. Hmm. So it wasn't until college where I took it more seriously.
Were you like a journal keeper as a kid?
Not really. I was. I actually still have my journals. But my journals tend to be more about goals. Hmm. I was a very productive thinking kid, and I would make goals in my journals. But actually, I still journal now. But I only journal when I'm really happy or really sad.
The best time to journal, actually.
Yeah. I wish I had a regular practice, but I haven't been able to make one.
Yeah, yeah. So I'm going to let you kind of lay the foundation for our discussion and talk a bit about the collection, kind of the scope of the stories and what was on your mind as a writer as the collection came together.
Yeah, so actually I for a while thought that I was working on two different collections. The first collection to my mind was broader and was about, I write about Jamaicans, I write about the anxieties of Jamaicans, but I thought that the first collection was broader in scope, and in my mind, I thought that the second collection was about gender and sexuality for Jamaicans, mm-hmm. And my agent really advised me not to think of them as separate collections. She thought that we might be able to find an arc within the stories, So for a year, she and I talked about the strongest stories and talked about what stories we could imagine working together, and that's basically what the book is.
Interesting. So how many stories were there originally, and then how many did you kind of have to cut out to make this one comprehensive collection?
There might be maybe 23 stories, and wow, we cut it down to 11 stories.
Wow. It's interesting that you say that, because you can see in these stories kind of a pull toward, I mean, I can see where this would have started as two collections, and then, but they all work so beautifully together. And I think, you know, the interesting part of a short story collection is that you've got each independent story that has to work on its own, and then they kind of have to be in conversation with each other, and they have to form their own narrative arc, and the ordering of the stories within the collection has to, you know, work and be in conversation with each other. So that's interesting that it was sort of your editor, perhaps, is sort of bird's eye view of the entirety of these stories to see how they might work together and fit together.
Yeah, it was actually my agent.
Oh, agent.
We spent, at the time it felt very obsessive. It was very laboring, but we spent, I think, a full year talking about order. Mm-hmm. Order was really important to us. We had a strong sense that Shirley from a Small Place had to end the collection. Mm. But yeah, it's really interesting to think about the fact that these were two separate collections at one point, because there's stories in the collection like Slack or Mashup Love that I can't imagine writing now because those stories came earlier. Mm. Slack was actually the first story was written my first year of graduate school, so this would have been 2012 or 2013, whereas stories like Light Skin Girls and Kelly Rowland's or the story Island, those stories feel very, very close to who I am now and to what I think about. Mm-hmm. If that makes sense.
It does. I also think it's interesting to put stories in juxtaposition with each other that have been from a writer's, you know, not only from a different point of your own life and what you were thinking about then, but also your writerly life and, you know, what kind of a writer you were 6 to 10, you know, 10 years ago or something versus what kind of writer you are today. And that too has to be kind of challenging because you'd probably go back to a story you wrote 6 years ago and say, I wouldn't write it the same way today, not only from a content perspective, but maybe even from a writerly perspective. And I don't know if you went back and revised those.
Yeah, no, actually, a couple, the ending of Mashup, so Mashup Love was also one of the earlier stories, and that's one story that has, well, the ending has changed a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
My editor felt that the story was pointing towards a conclusion that didn't really happen, so I did go back to that story. Yeah, it was an interesting process to work on stories that are essentially 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I do agree with you. I think that these stories definitely trace how I've evolved as a person. I think that these stories really speak to my 20s. The first story I wrote when I was maybe 23 or 24, and I'm now 30.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that the collection really speaks to how I've grown as a person and as a writer.
Yeah. Yeah, I was going to ask you if you found that the collection taught you anything about, you know, I always think that fiction is a kind of an interesting way to explore our own identity and to process our own identity. And I always wonder if writers learn something about themselves, as women or men or as or as writer. And I wondered if coming through the course of this collection, if you emerged from the other side, a different person, and kind of what surprised you about that?
Well,
that's a hard question.
Huh? It's a hard question, but also a really good question. I've never been asked that question before. I think whenever people read the collection and tell me that they've read the collection, I do feel shy because I do think that as a writer, your emotional life definitely comes across because, you know, the fiction is interested in what you're interested in. So I do think that these stories speak to my anxieties. A lot of these stories were written when I was in a place of pain.
Mm-hmm.
So I feel really grateful that it's become a thing that I hope can be a comfort to people in the way that the books I love have been a comfort to me.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's interesting. I was talking to a writer last week, and she was saying how many people had come up to her and said, I feel like you're telling my secrets. I feel like you're in my head. And what a great gift for a writer to have made that connection with strangers, you know, that they feel like you're telling my stories and, you know, how did you know these things about these intimate things about me? And I think, you know, isn't that the writer's goal? So that's a cool thing.
Yeah. I guess I've gotten that so far from a lot of Jamaican readers, and it definitely feels very exciting every single time I hear it.
Yeah. So I don't know. I mean, this seems, I'm guessing it wasn't your intent when you set out to write the collection, but it's such an important time to have these conversations about immigration. And, you know, I always think it's interesting to talk about the world the book is born into, and it's probably an unintentional world this book was born into with immigration on people's minds. And I was wondering if there's any sense in which you feel some responsibility to add to the cultural discussion, or if you feel like your only obligation is really strictly to the story and storytelling.
I definitely think that fiction has to be in conversation with the times. I think for me, I'm just moved by fiction. Like that, those are the kinds of books that have been really important to me as a reader. But as a writer, I write about I write for myself. I write about what I'm thinking about. I try to be in conversation with my own anxieties. And it's beautiful to me that I think it can speak to a larger experience. I write about immigration a lot because it's my family's, it's my family story. And I've just thought about it a lot because my family and I came to the U.S. when I was 12, and I just have always felt this sense of otherness living in New York. My family and I were undocumented for a lot of those years, so I always felt like a foreigner in the U.S. and at times unwanted in the U.S. So it's where my imagination goes. And I'm just really grateful. I think if someone is struck by the fact that it speaks to their experience, I think that's a beautiful thing.
Yeah, yeah. Talk a little bit about the time and distance required to render setting. A lot of these stories are set in Jamaica. They're set in Brooklyn. They're set in Iowa. And I'm curious if it's easier to be settled inside the geography you're writing about, or if it's easier for you to have some distance and perspective away from it. Which places felt kind of easier to access depending on where you physically were located when you were writing about them?
I think for me, I think that might actually be a question of if I feel conflict or tension or a sense of longing for a place. I mentioned earlier that my family had been undocumented for basically until I was 24. So I had lived in the U.S. up until that point for 24 years. And I hadn't been able to go back to Jamaica. So my imagination would always go there. A lot of the stories, a lot of the houses that I imagine are my grandmother's house.
I think those places that we grow up are so, they're so visceral, you know? I think a lot of us live there in our heads, in our grandma's house, and eating all that food, and, you know, all those memories are so visceral. I always thought it was because when you don't have language for something, when you're someplace pre-verbal, and you just are taking in the senses, and you don't have words to put to all those feelings and things you're experiencing, that your author imagination spends more time there, because now you're trying to give language to something that, you know, just kind of lives in your bones instead of lives in your head. I don't know if that makes any sense.
I think a lot of my stories, I have a couple of stories in the collection. Well, I think three stories in the collection that are set in the Midwest. Two are set in Iowa City and one is in Madison. And I think those stories for me were born out of a displacement I felt living in the Midwest. The fact that I had to be there, I had to finish my book, but it didn't feel like home. So I think for me, setting is about exploring what it's like to be in a place.
I love some of your opening lines. I'm just going to read a couple of opening lines from a couple of different stories, because I've kind of been obsessed with openings lately and how authors, especially short story writers, find their way into a piece. So I keep looking at people's writers, the way they access a story. So in Mashup Love, the first line is, "Mama used to say that sinful things happen before light comes back in the sky." And How to Love a Jamaican. "The Israelites used to send a goat out into the wilderness and leave the animal, the sins there." One last one, "The Ghost of G.A.E." I'm probably pronouncing her name wrong. Tiffany can't sleep when she hears the police found G.A.E., the missing international student, dead in the trunk of her car. And I was wondering if you could just talk for a second about beginnings of stories. So you're sitting there with the blank screen and the blinking cursor, and you do what? Kind of how do you find your way into your stories?
Yeah, I think a first sentence has to hook a reader. First sentences come to me, and I think that's when I know I have a story. I think a first sentence has to be evocative, but has to somehow also present something mysterious. Toni Morrison, all of her novels have really good first sentences. Whenever I teach fiction, I write her novels. I write the first sentence of, I think, 5 of her novels on the board, and my students and I talk about these sentences. I'm big into a really good first sentence. And then everything that follows is really hard for me, but for some reason, when I have a good first sentence, I know I have a story.
And so it sounds like the first sentence usually sticks, that you have to get that before you can keep going.
Yes, and it usually doesn't change.
Okay.
Actually, it's never changed, I don't think.
Dang.
Not in the stories in the collection.
That's amazing. So, and you, it also really has to establish point of view and voice. I mean, it has to do all of these things.
Yeah.
So you, that's cool. That's cool that whatever it is guides you on. Is that the way the rest of the process works, where you feel like sentence number 2 and sentence number 52, like each one has to work until you get to the next one?
No, because the sentences to come may not end up in the final draft.
Okay.
Sometimes as I make my way through a story, it's really hard for me to know what rings as truth, especially for a character. So I feel my way through a story, and when at the end, when I read it through, it quickly becomes evident, or sometimes not so quickly. Sometimes it takes months or weeks. I have to sense what feels organic, what's working, what isn't. All of the sentences definitely are not, they don't come to me as easily as the first sentence does.
I guess I would have known that because you were talking about having revised the ending of a few stories so many times, so that makes sense.
Yeah.
Beginnings are sometimes easy and sometimes sometimes they're hard, but sometimes, yeah, I love that they come the easiest.
Yeah, beginnings for me, I think, feel very organic. And endings for me can sometimes also feel that way. It's the stuff in the middle that's really hard.
Yeah, right. So many writers talk about that. My guest this morning is Alexia Arthurs. The book is How to Love a Jamaican. You're listening to Writers on Writing on KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine. So I thought maybe we could take a couple of these stories. Maybe you talked about Mashup Love being one of the older ones, but maybe we could take a couple of these that either were kind of the most complicated for you to write, or one or two that have resonance for you, and kind of dissect them. So talk about the original kernel of the idea, talk about some of the authorial decisions that you made along the way, maybe certain complications that came up or difficulties that you had to grapple with, finding the right ending, maybe just, Alexia Arthurs on how to write one of these short stories. I don't know which one would make sense to do, but.
Can we talk about We Eat Our Daughters?
Oh, love it. Yes. There's a lot of eating and devouring of children and women in this book, which I also love, but we can talk about that later. Okay, so how do we eat our daughters? So talk first about kind of the original very first idea, and then how, you know, what you jumped off from in that, and then kind of how it evolved.
Yes, so We Eat Our Daughters is a story about mother-daughter relationship told from the POV of the daughters. And so when I wrote this story, it was 4 vignettes. And my editor, my agent actually, she sent it to an editor who had the idea that the first vignette should be its own story.
Hmm.
And this was actually Lauren Stein. He thought that it could function as its own story, so that story became Bad Behavior.
Hmm, okay.
And that's also in the collection.
Mm-hmm.
So then I was left with this story that had three vignettes that felt, it felt unfinished. So I wrote, I pulled a snippet of something from somewhere else and played around, and that became a fourth vignette. So then my struggle with this story was trying to figure out how to order these vignettes, because they all feel so different.
Yeah.
And they're such different stories.
Right.
I thought about order for a long time.
So what was the most difficult? It sounds like ordering was the most difficult part. So you wrote these kind of three vignettes independent of each other, but probably with the thought in the back of your mind that these were going to be connected to each other in some way, yes?
No, I wrote it as a story told in vignettes.
Okay.
So in my mind, it was always a short story. It would just, but it would have these little stories within the story, and it would tell a full, it would tell a larger story about mother-daughter Jamaican relationships.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool. And so when you were writing what then became Bad Behavior, that was conceived of within this framework of the mother-daughter relationships and then sort of excised out and made into its own animal.
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, exactly. So Bad Behavior was actually the last vignette in We Eat Our Daughters.
Gotcha.
And it became its own story, but then I pulled something from somewhere else, and that something else became the first vignette in What Is We Eat Our Daughters.
That is very cool. And then talk a little bit about the revision process. So you have the stories, you have the story done, and when do you, I think this is always hard for short story writers, when you know the story is done, because it's so easy to keep fiddling with it forever. And when do you feel like a story is finished for you and you can put it, you know, put it to bed?
For me, a story feels finished if it feels as though the characters have come to some kind of a, if something has shifted for them mm-hmm. emotionally. I write from a place of exploring a character's, or characters, plural, relationship to themselves and also to the world. So a story to me feels finished if I feel like I told a character's story in an honest, authentic way and something has shifted for them.
Which I guess it brings us to our question about how endings of short stories, I think, are so complicated because they're, unlike novels, they're not intended to really wrap everything up in a nice bow. And I think it's hard for, I think a lot of short story writers, especially new ones, tend to overwrite a short story and try to explain too much rather than leaving it on that sort of unsettled, uncomfortable ending that I just love of the short story form. And I was wondering if you had any kind of thoughts on that, of when you know you've arrived at the right ending, and if that was true of you, if you tended to overwrite some of these and then had to pull back?
I'm thinking of the endings, if I've had to rewrite any of the endings.
Some of them sound like they changed, right? Like Mashup Love changed?
Yeah, so Mashup Love, at the end of Mashup Love, basically, in the original ending, he had a conversation with his wife about seeing his brother, and that was the end.
Mm-hmm.
And my editor, felt that the story was pointing to another conclusion that never delivered. So I thought about it, and I spent a lot of time thinking about it. So how that story now ends is that he and his wife have the opportunity to possibly emigrate to the U.S.
It's very cool.
Which,
go ahead.
Yeah, I mean, as a writer, it's sometimes hard to know how your story is working in an objective sense. But that ending did feel natural to me for this marriage and for these two characters.
Yes, yeah, right.
But I do agree with you that endings should feel as complicated as real life. In our lives, nothing is ever tied up. We're constantly in conflict, even if we decide to go right instead of left.
Uh-huh.
And I hope that my stories speak to that tension that we're always having to engage with as human beings.
Right, right. Yeah, that's what I love about the short story form, that they're always a little unsettling. We're drawing down on our time. It's killing me. I have 1,800 more questions, but maybe you can leave us with some writerly wisdom and advice. Having finished your debut collection, I know you went through the MFA at Iowa, and I know you're teaching a bit. What sort of advice has been the best you've received along the way, or something you've learned along the way that keeps sustaining you?
That keeps sustaining me. Someone asked me this recently, and I think it was an interview I did with poets and writers, but actually when I was graduating high school, my photography teacher at that time basically encouraged me to be involved in art making,
mm-hmm.
and he gave me a book, a photography book, and he wrote that inside. And I think that's how I encourage my students.
Hmm.
I think that the work is what one should focus on, and everything else is a distraction. The other thing, and I think that this is really important for young writers, is that there's no hurry to publish.
Yeah,
there really isn't.
Right, right. And there are so many distractions, and there's so many people eager to publish that I think that is eternally good advice. That's great.
There really isn't. I'm really glad. When I went to the workshop, I had classmates who were selling books when they were 25 and 24 and 26. And there's nothing wrong with that. But that it isn't going to be everyone's story, and there's nothing wrong with that. I prefer to publish a better book at 40 than to publish... Than to rush a book that isn't where it should be when I'm 24.
And writing, unlike sports or something, only gets better with more life experience and more life observation. You know, it's writing is more like wine. You know, the longer it sits on the shelf, probably the better it's going to be. You know,
I think so too.
As opposed to, you know, football players.
Yeah, definitely.
Oh. Alexia Arthurs, this was such a pleasure. Thank you so much for taking the time.
Thank you. It was really good to hear your voice.
Thank you.
And to talk to you.
Thanks so much.